wherever you are around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth2letteru.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is the birthday boy, Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, mate.
Good day.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, it's my birthday. We're doing this recording on my birthday.
We're doing the last recording on your birthday. This is the last chapter of 1 Samuel on your birthday.
Yeah, but don't mislead people. It's not the last recording. It's the last recording now for a while. For different reasons. Yeah, we're taking a break. First of all, we've been recording nonstop for 2.5 years now.
Yeah.
Okay. And we've done, I think, over 90 programs based on what you told me.
Yeah, yeah. It's about 90 programs that you and I have recorded.
It's about 90 programs. I have the largest number of programs on Truth to You.
That's true. And let's not beat around the bush. The reason why we're going to take a break is until I get more likes on my Facebook page than your Facebook page, then we'll start recording again, right? That's what it's about.
Well, it's not really about that. There's several things going on. I mean, for example, first of all, this is going to be we're going to do a moon sighting. This is going to come out already after the moon sighting, but there's a moon sighting which starts the 7th month. Mm-hmm. There's feasts. It's going to be a very messy...
You've become a student. Come on, tell the people.
Wait. We have a saying, davar davar, each thing at its time. Wait for it. This is going to be a very hectic month for me because it's going to be, you know, there's the biblical feast versus the rabbinic feast. So, you know, in my house, my wife follows the rabbinic calendar. So I have to, you know, at least somewhat...
You get to do them twice.
Yeah, I don't believe in doing it twice. And it's going to be very hectic for me with work because I have to shuffle students around and have these massive crunch days where I have like 5-6 students in one day just because I can't have them on their regular day. Mm. And I'm losing some work. It's going to be pretty messy. That's one thing. So I'm not going to have any time to get ready for these recordings. And also in October, you know, because of the 7th month is falling on September, the school year is beginning in October.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I just actually got a whole pile of books on First Temple history. There's another pile of books that has to show up as a, you know, intro to biblical studies. So I have a lot of studying to do. I have papers I'm going to have to give. It's pretty exciting. I mean, you said earlier, you know, that you know it's overdue and I should have done this years ago. And yeah, this is true. But years ago, for example, I didn't have the wonderful people that listen to Truth to You, the wonderful people that donated money to help out. Mm. You know, by donating, we got great listeners. So by donating, people really made it easier for me to go to the university and sign up. It's not cheap. It's really not cheap, but everyone here on Truth to You and everyone in the future that might hear me, and God willing, you know, the plans of, you know, at one point going out and doing a speaking tour in the United States, you know, everyone's going to benefit from this. So not only me personally on the level of the knowledge and the level of the work it's going to produce for me, but also from the fact that, you know, I'm going to go out and I'm going to meet
share
new
the information that you learn, right?
Share the information, and you know, this also makes me an academic. You know, so this is, I got credit as a religious student, as a person who just you know, as a follower of Torah, and you know, as a friend of mine said, you know, the University of God.
Mm.
He said Yudhevavhe, but you know, that's basically what I mean. He's 100% correct. I mean, before there were universities, you know, your stature as a person of Torah and a person of knowledge was how much did you actually know?
Mm.
So it's actually really funny because I was looking over the question, because what they do, this is the Open University. So what you do is you write papers and they ask you specific questions to focus your papers on specific information. And I'm reading through, for example, the first paper I have to write. I was like, I know 95% of this without even cracking open the
books. You're familiar with a whole lot of stuff already, and you're going to be doing, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's linguistics and biblical studies primarily, right?
Actually, no. Linguistics is going to be the master's. It's changed.
There we go.
The plan is slightly changed. What's going to be done is a major in ancient history, with a minor, which is going to be almost 50%. So it's really going to be funny because almost 50% of my diploma is actually going to be biblical studies.
Mm-hmm.
But because there is, the OpenU does not have biblical studies as a major, I was told take history as a major, but inside the history, there's like a huge, if you take an ancient history, there's a huge chunk just about biblical studies.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing the biblical studies, I'm also doing part of the history. For example, my first course that I just received here I'm doing two courses this time because three would just be overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Then these are two very, very big courses. They're worth a lot of points and they're pretty big.
Mm.
But these two courses are basically the one course is already history, so I'm already starting my history major, and another course is biblical studies. The big joke is going to be that I'm also going to be taking the course in biblical Hebrew just for the fun of it. You know, I'm just gonna go and say,
oh,
no,
why not?
It's worth having. Like, for example, from now on, if anyone says to me, you know, what are your credentials on biblical Hebrew? So, well, I have that as part of my, you know, I did this as part of my university course, you know, so I already have also the university stamp on such a thing. You know, so it's no longer just me self-study and 3 years. No, we did Hebrew in high school, which is a lot of the basics of also biblical Hebrew. And then for the past, you know, what is it, 15 years, I think, I've been studying the Bible in biblical Hebrew. You know, there are a lot of little bits and pieces I had to learn and refurbish and stuff like that. And now I'm really researching into heavier things and reading some very interesting books at the moment. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have time for them.
You've got to get into the groove of study, and that's what you're doing. That's exciting stuff. The other thing that's happening is it seems, Yoel, that Keith announced another tour. We are intending.
Oh, God.
He's intending to come back. In March, so you got to make yourself available. You know, at least some evenings when we're over there. But to let everybody know, he hasn't even given us the details yet. But we hopefully by this coming Shabbat, we'll have details that people can see whether or not they can make it. But there's a whole lot of people that have put up their hand already. Not only new people, but a whole lot of people that were on the last tour that have said, "Yeah, we're coming."
Okay, nice. So I mean, the last tour was fun. It was great. You know, I went with the days I joined the group. I had lots of fun. People were very, very, very nice. Very, very good group. It was a really, really good group. And some of the people are still in touch with me. So it's lots of fun. You know, so by the way, if there's anyone out there who's supposed to be in Jerusalem for Sukkot, you know, drop me an email. Let's meet up.
HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael is the Facebook page as well. We better start chapter 31. What do you reckon?
Well, first of all, you were asking me a question about Damascus in Isaiah. Was Isaiah 17?
Isaiah 17. Now, the reason why
it's all over the news. I mean, I got you know, questions from certain, you know, people from the Hebrews. Like, what do you think of Isaiah 17? And different people are asking me about this.
Let me say something about that, Yoel, because Christians, particularly some sects of Christianity, some expressions, some denominations of Christianity, if you like, even in the Messianic movement, are very, very quick to speculate. And I don't subscribe to a lot of that eschatological speculation. But when Jewish sources, Jewish news sources, start floating these prophecies, then that kind of gets my attention. And I did see, and I don't recall if it was Israel National News or if it was another Israeli news source, but they did float the prophecy of Isaiah 17 in regards to Damascus becoming a ruinous heap. The burden of Damascus, this is Isaiah 17, the burden of Damascus, behold, Damascus will cease from being a city and it will be a ruinous heap. Now, that doesn't mean to say that it will never be inhabited again, does it? Or is that what it means? Well, because we have a prophecy about Babylon in that regard.
So, I mean, let's look at that for a second. I mean, we're dealing with the book of Samuel, but we don't really, it's a very short chapter what we have. So let's look at this for a second. So let me open up Isaiah. Because the question is, when in history was Damascus destroyed?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's Masa Damesek. A Masa is a form of a prophecy. It's called upon a specific place. So it says, Hine Damesek Musar Me'ir Vaita Me'ir Mapala. So Damascus will be removed from being a city, and will be a pile of rubble. But the thing is, the point is as follows. Verse 3, Nishbat mivtzar me'efraim u'amlacha midamesek u'shar aram, kichvod b'nei Yisrael yehiyu ne'um Adonai Tzevaot. The parallel here between verses 1 and 2 to verse 3 connects the fall of Damascus to the fall of Ephraim. Okay? So this cannot be a future prophecy. It's a prophecy that's already been completed. So what does Damascus actually represent? Now, the thing is, I have a note here in my Bible, says Damascus was destroyed in the year 732 BC during the revolt of Ratzin.
Mm-hmm.
So Damascus was actually destroyed at some stage. Now, when it says destroyed, it doesn't say complete destruction, but it says that it will be a pile of rubble, etc. So a pile of rubble can also mean that certain buildings still stand. Mm-hmm. And it really, if you read the whole prophecy, you continue to verse 4, and it'll be on that day the glory of Judah, of Jacob, will dwindle, and the fat of his flesh will become thin, and he will be like a field that was collected, and his arm, which is strength, would be like harvested wheat, which has basically been removed. So you look at this, you know, and then it says here, on that day, this is verse 7, on that day a man will turn his eyes, a man will lean on his Creator, and his eyes to the Holy One of Israel, it will look, and he will no longer lean on the altars, the creation of his hands, which his fingers have made, they will not look to, and the Asherim and the Chamanim, which types of idols.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then it says, on that day, your cities, your fortified cities will be an abandoned pile, which they left before because of the sons of Israel, which is during, this is referencing to when they conquered the land, the nations just ran away, and it would be desolate. Okay, so you look at this, and you say, first of all, we have a reference that Damascus was destroyed. Then we have connections here to the time of the kingdoms of Ephraim. And Ephraim and Menasheh are the northern kingdom, that the northern kingdom will fall together with Damascus. This is connected to the Assyrian Empire that conquered basically the Levant and basically conquered the northern part of Israel and actually reached Jerusalem. Because Isaiah, you have to remember, Isaiah 1 all the way to chapter 40 leads and builds up to these prophecies that have to do with the issue of the saving of Jerusalem. Now, there are prophecies here and there that do seem to be futuristic, but in general the prophecies in Isaiah from 1 all the way to 40, basically 39, already things have been fulfilled, except for a few very specific prophecies which there's no debate if they're in the future or not. And I'm not talking, for example, about the prophecy, was Isaiah 9, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm not talking about that, because Isaiah 9, you know, it's really forcing the text that's talking about the future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's really forcing the text. I mean, regardless to the issue, and I'm going to talk now like an academic. Forget about my beliefs. It's really forcing the text. It's actually a term which means to rape the text. This is really, that's a term that's used. It's really forcing the text. But there are places where it's clear it is a future prophecy. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Here as well, this is a prophecy that seems it's already been fulfilled. Okay? It doesn't mean that Damascus won't fall again because of the behavior of its leaders. Okay, it doesn't mean that Damascus won't fall again, that Syria won't fall again. But to tell you the truth, as an analysis of the Middle East and Middle Eastern cultures, it would be very, very, very stupid for anyone, okay, to try to attack Syria or even invade it. Mm-hmm. I understand the will of the world to correct everything, but look at the mess in North Africa. Look at the mess in Iraq. Look at the mess in Afghanistan. Look at the mess of Vietnam. Every time a Western country gets involved, okay, it just becomes messy.
Mm.
The UN caused the death of, I can't even know what the numbers are, but people in Bosnia, Herzegovina, you know, all that story that went on back in the 80s and the 90s, thousands upon thousands of people died because the West got involved. It was a lot of people died just because of that. Not the war, not just the issue of the civil war that went on there and the wars with the Chechens and everything. We're talking about a Western involvement that took things out of balance and more people died.
Mm.
Okay, for example, how did the Taliban and Al-Qaeda become where it is today? One very, very simple reason. The Americans gave them weapons when they were fighting, when the Taliban was fighting against the Russians. I actually sat down with a Russian friend who was older than me, and he was a kid back in the Taliban wars, and we spoke about this, and he looked at me, and we had to agree, and we said the Americans were super dumb when they did this. How do you think Iran is Iran of today, this crazy Muslim country? If you go to YouTube and you look Iran before the exile of the Shah or something, Iran was a very Western country. They had oil, they could have made the world a better place. No, we're the Americans. We don't like the Shah. He's becoming too powerful. We're going to bring him down. By bringing him down, you've
chaos
created chaos in the world. So I think, I personally think it's healthier the United States and the West keeps out of Syria.
It's very valid what you say, Will, because there
and,
is
and by the way, chaos. they're arming the rebels, and that's going to backfire. That's going to become even more dangerous mm-hmm. for the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because in the rebels there are fundamentalists. There's that movement something in Nusra. These guys are the bearers of the black flags of what is it the black files of flags of what's the name of that thing. It sounds like Khorasan or something, but there's the black flags, which this is a Muslim messianic movement.
Yeah, really.
Okay, there's the thing of the black flags. If you ever look into it, there's a thing called the black flags of Khorasan or something like that, or something that effect. This is an Islamic messianic movement.
Mm.
These are people that believe that through war they will bring in the 12th,
yes.
the 12th imam.
Iman. Yeah.
These guys are crazy. Mm. These guys are dangerous to the entire world.
Amen.
Okay, so I personally think America should stay out. It's because you need to understand the Middle East, and it seems that the United States has never understood how the Eastern world works, or the Middle East, and they try to read the world based on Western standards, and it doesn't work. This is the world might be smaller, it might seem to be smaller, but it's much, much bigger. And so summing up this prophecy, just by reading a few passages, okay, from a few verses, it seems that this prophecy has already been fulfilled, so there's no. Sure. I don't think there's any future prophecy here.
Sure. In any case, you will. I mean, it is a little unstable, but it's always a little bit unstable, right? I mean, there's always something going on in a neighboring country that's causing a little bit of trouble. In this case, the headlines, it's Syria, and the repercussions of a possible hit on Syria, you know, there have been speculations that it could be big. But, you know, I remember last time when we were thinking about coming to Israel, and I think if I remember correctly, yeah, well, it was Iran and its nuclear program and a possible strike on Iran. There's always something, right?
There's always something going on. The problem is that people hesitate.
Well, in any case, I am looking forward to coming back and seeing you, my friend, and returning to Israel this coming March. And just a reminder to the listeners, they can expect details from Keith. So let's get into it, because this is the last chapter of 1 Samuel. This is chapter 31. This is entitled, in my New King James Study Bible, it's entitled The Tragic End of Saul and His Sons. I think that's fair. And it says...
It doesn't really tell us too much personal information. It just describes in a very, very painful way. This is actually quite common in the Bible, that there's less of a personal description, more of a general description of what happened. Tries not to dwell too long on these things.
Mm.
There is a very, very short discussion here, but it really cuts it very short. This is also a very, very short chapter. It's 13 verses. And it just cuts into the story, just tells you what happened, and just finishes off with that.
Mm.
It doesn't dwell too long on the battle itself. But, you know, usually, sometimes you have description of the battle is like very, very clear. This happened, that happened. You know, for example, when there was the battle of the two kings against the king of Aram, then there's a very, very detailed description there. Here, it's as if the writer's not too interested in describing this. It's just too painful.
Yeah, yeah, it does feel like that. You're right. And as you have mentioned before, we go back and forth and back and forth from the scenes with Saul and the scenes with David. We've just had a couple of chapters of David, and now chapter 31 continues on from the, is it chapter 28, the witch of Endor, the medium
yeah,
of Endor.
The medium of Endor, yeah.
And so here we are, and it says, now the Philistines fought against Israel. Oh, by the way, let me go back, because just to bring everyone up to date, Samuel does say, after the medium of Endor brought him up, he delivers the news to Shaul that says, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. And Saul was dreadfully afraid, it says. And here we find the situation in chapter 31. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard after Saul, Yoel, hard after him and his sons. And the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab and Malchishua. Now, who's this guy? Have we heard of him before?
Yeah, there's a whole discussion here about the names of his sons. You know, it mentions other names somewhere else. It's not very clear why do we suddenly have all these different names that show up. There's like
Ishbosheth.
Yeah, well, Ishbosheth survives because Ishbosheth never went out. Yeah, I mean, a grandson of his survives. His son Ishbosheth survives. Maybe Ishbosheth wasn't old enough to go to the battle. Maybe he wasn't part of the retainers. I don't know. He was not in the battle itself. So we have Ishbosheth, son of Shaul. We have Mephibosheth. It mentions another person called Mephibosheth. By the way, Boshet is another name for Baz. So Ishbosheth is really Ishbal.
Really? Didn't know that.
I've had discussions with Nehemiah about this one. Maybe we never had it with you. If you actually go into the Book of Chronicles, it mentions some of the names. And then all the ones that are called Boshet are actually called Baal.
Really?
Yeah.
How about
so the Bosh, the name Boshet actually shows up, I think, in the Book of Isaiah. So the Herbetem Mizbachot LaBoshet. You have created many altars to the Boshet, and the Boshet is really Baal.
Ah, right. Well, in any case, three of his sons die, including Jonathan, which is terribly sad. The battle became fierce against Shaul, and the archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. And then Shaul says to his armor-bearer, draw your sword.
By the way, this is not the first time. This is the first time a king died. In the description of the Bible, a king dies from the archers. But King Achav was also killed by the archers. And it looks as if there were, you know, first of all, archery was a very, very useful weapon because you just can create a shower of arrows.
Mm.
The only danger is that you can only, if you care about your soldiers, you don't create the shower of arrows until, you know, unless you're doing the first attack.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're already in the battlefield, what the archers do is they go back and then the footmen go forward, and footmen can be carrying different types of weapons. I actually was listening yesterday to a lecture about weapons in the ancient world. So you had swords, right. You had clubs, you have rocks. So the guys who were the archers and basically the artillery of the time would move back. And then what they did was they would target people from distance. So these were like sharpshooters. They were positioned different places. So sometimes they also had, the king would have arrow bearers around him as well. To stop any attack from the distance. I mean, it really depends because, for example, if you look at depictions of kings from the ancient world, it always looks as if they're in the battle itself, which might be a lot of nonsense, you know, because you read the descriptions, I did this and I did that. And really what happened was a few thousand people died for me, mm-hmm. and I just walked in and said, oh, it's mine. You know, I did this. they do a description. There's a symbolic killing. You know, the king mm-hmm. goes in and he symbolically cuts off the head of someone who walks around with the head saying, oh, I did mm-hmm. this. That was mine. You know, but it's not really them. He might be sitting on some hill far, far away managing the battle, which is also normal because if you're the strategist, you have to be outside. You have to see from a distance.
Sure.
This way, for example, valleys, okay, were very, very popular for battle. First of all, because of the issue of the valleys easier for chariots and horsemen and in general. But also what it means is that captains or officers and kings can stand on a hill nearby and look down into the valley and see the strategy. Now, also remember, they did wear some kind of a uniform, okay? And also the uniform, wearing a uniform back then wasn't just an issue like, oh, look how pretty I look with this, with my peacock feather or something. You know, it was more of an issue of like...
We had an emu feather.
An emu feather.
Yeah.
Cool. You know, so the thing is that you wear different types of clothing and different types of uniforms because what you're trying to do is on a battlefield, first you want to identify your own soldiers, but also you want to identify the types of soldiers on the field. So, mm-hmm. for example, if you suddenly see a unit of archers move to a place you don't want them, you send out a messenger telling them, get out of there, you know. Mm-hmm. But you have to be able to recognize these people from a distance. So the thing is here that a king usually wore a specific type of clothing. It was possible to recognize a king in a battlefield based on his uniform. Usually the king wore an actual piece of armor. It might have been something a lot more expensive. Usually the chariot looked a little different, so it was easier to target him.
Mm.
So they knew
who to follow, right?
You knew who to follow. And also part of the issue was the king was like the flag. Basically, if the king still stands, the battle can be won. Mm-hmm. It gives hope for people, and it's also a symbol of the battle. So, for example, a king that doesn't really show up in the field is considered to be a coward. But sometimes, you know, strategy calls don't go down to the field.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that there were certain, it seems that there were certain rules of engagement back then that, you know, if you were just a regular soldier, you were not allowed to attack a king.
Mm-hmm.
A king was only to be allowed to be attacked by a person who's high ranking.
Sure.
But it looks as if it was common for kings to be attacked by archers. So it might be that these are archers that were close by to the Philistines or the rulers of the Philistines. But again, the Philistines didn't have kings. They had kings of cities, so they had chieftains and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Israel, on the other hand, had a king, so it's different.
Mm.
So it's not really clear who would have killed him, but it's clear that these were archers.
Very good point.
Okay, and they targeted him because really, by him falling, the morale drops. Now, you also have to remember there is a way of getting out of such a situation where someone else manages the battle. Someone else, well, the king's down. We're not going to lose this because there's a lot more at stake, just the king dying. And just one guy jumps in the chariot, get the king out. He gets in the king's chariot and he, you know, carries the banner and says, okay, whatever, after me, let's continue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, but no one does this here, which kind of shows...
It seems like the battle is already in disarray, right?
The battle's in disarray, but it also shows something about the problematic form of Saul's kingdom. He was a king, but his kingship was kind of like iffy. Because you have to remember, this is the first king that Israel has after centuries of just being an alliance of tribes, kind of like what they had in Rome, in Greece, where there was, you know, we have, you know, some mutual aspects, like, you know, we speak the same language, we more or less follow the same god, you know, we have the same feasts, we kind of have the same centers of religion, not exactly. So this was a confederacy of tribes.
Mm-hmm.
So by the king dying, okay, the heck with it, we're getting out of here. You know, this was the attitude. And this is why the battle was lost so easily, because there was no one else to jump on the helm and say, okay, let's carry on.
True.
They were just, each tribe said, well, you know, the leaders of the tribe go like, you know, he's dead. Okay, let's get out of here. You know, that was the attitude.
So true. And so verse 4, Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword, thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me. Now, what does he mean by abuse me? He's talking about them messing up his body or torturing before they kill him?
Well, it's a long list of things that can be done. I mean, there's torture, there's abuse, being taken captive, being blinded, cover your ears, cases of rape.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things, a lot of kings that were taken captive, put in dungeons.
Yeah.
And he was afraid. But here's a question. Suicide.
This is the question. And I actually had someone ask me this question. What is the Bible's, what is the position of Judaism in regards to suicide? And we see a double
You're asking two different questions. You're asking, what does the Bible say about suicide and what Judaism says about suicide?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And as well, let me just read this part, because it says, therefore, it says his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore, Shaul took a sword and fell on it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Shaul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. So Shaul, his three sons, his armor-bearer, and all his men, that is the men that were assigned to protect him, they died together that same day. So to be honest, Yoel, if I put myself in the situation and the horrible list, as you mentioned, of things that were likely to happen to him should he remain alive until he was captured by the enemy, I think I'm likely to fall on my sword.
Yeah, so that's a question. I mean, this question has been asked a lot. The sanctity of life, you know, the issue of dying for certain things, you know, what's more important.
Because at least he still dies with some dignity, right?
Exactly. So we don't see any criticism in the Bible. By the way, this is one of the very, very few cases of suicide. We have a few other people that commit suicide. Joab commits suicide later on in the Book of Kings. We have people who are asked to be, put to death after something pretty nasty. Like, for example, it was Achimelech. What was it? Achimelech, I think it was?
Mm-hmm.
Or was it? No, Avimelech. Avimelech. He asked someone to stab him after his skull was cracked open.
That's right.
To finish himself off.
Yeah.
So we have a few cases of suicide or to be put to death by someone's will. By the person's will in the Bible, and we don't hear any criticism about this.
Mm-hmm.
There's no description, there's no criticism that says, oh, the person died like this. Then later on in Judaism, we start having descriptions of, you know, the lack of respect to life. And, you know, you have no right to remove something that God decided should be on this earth. So there are.
But Yoel, we also have
the criticism about this. Yeah,
we also have the example of Masada, right?
Well, the story of Masada is a story by itself because they came from a very specific standpoint. These were the zealots. So the zealots believed that they had no ruler besides God. So it was against God's will that anyone else will rule over them. So by being taken captive, they're breaking the will of God. Now, it doesn't say like that anything in the Bible. The Bible actually tells you that if you sin against God, you'll be punished and taken away and will have rulers upon you, which are not your real ruler. Mm-hmm. So their suicide, again, the fact that they were willing to commit suicide, and again, you can argue on one hand that they were broke Torah because Torah said X, Y, Z. But on the other hand, you don't see anywhere in the Torah prohibition of committing suicide. It doesn't say, thou shalt not murder yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It says, don't murder someone else. If you take your own life, we don't see any description of this. So it's a question. Now, do I support suicide? The answer is heck no. And I don't think that people should take away their own lives. If there's something wrong, try to solve it. The question is, what happens in situations like this, and there are stories. I mean, for example, you know, during the Holocaust, if a person was taken prisoner by the Nazis, was it really better to commit suicide? And the thing is that, for example, if you're an operative, if you had information, it would probably be better that you do commit suicide.
There were a lot of people, Yoel, and it was put this way, that threw themselves at the mercy of the electric fence.
Exactly. Chana Senesh, for example, refused to commit suicide. She was tortured.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know who Chana Senesh is, she was a paratrooper. She got out of Europe, came to Israel, was trained I can't remember who it was. At the time by the military units here in Israel, was sent back to Europe and she was captured. She parachuted into Europe and she was captured on a train. They spotted her and she was captured on a train and she was tortured. I mean, I read about what they did to her. It was horrendous. Mm. And then she was executed. Okay. But from what I remember, they claimed that she never spoke. They claimed that they never got any information from her. Mm. So, there are situations. This is what Kegelation Saul did. He said, it's better off I commit suicide instead of these things happening to me.
Mm.
So we don't see any criticism in the Bible about the concept of suicide. And really, suicide is done, for example, with Joab. It's almost like the seppuku from the Japanese seppuku, also known as harakiri, where it's an honorable execution. You kill yourself instead of living with the shame. So Joab, that's kind of like what he did. But we don't see any criticism on suicide, and suicide was done in very specific situations. And also suicide. I mean, for example, there was a whole thing I read about. There were a whole bunch of farmers in India that committed suicide, massive suicide, as a demonstration against Monsanto, against the seed company. That's what I read. From what I remember, I read that some time back.
Mm.
Or for example, in India, it's expected amongst Hindus, it's expected that a wife would jump into the fire when their husband dies and they're burning his body. And we're talking about body burning in a moment. Mm. It's expected of her to jump into the fire and die with her husband. So that's suicide. So it seems that in the ancient world, and even to this very day, suicide in certain situations is considered to be an honorable death.
Mm-hmm.
But we have this notion, and it starts showing up in more after the Second Temple period, where this thing of the sanctity of life and suicide is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first Europeans to go to Japan were shocked by the concept of, you know, a person is asking his master to commit suicide.
Mm.
It's not that the master says, well, you have to die. You know, the guy walks up and says, listen, I can't bear the shame. I want to die. You know, it's not this. So the Europeans were shocked. And in Judaism as well, there are, there's this literature about the issue of suicide. For example, they say a person who committed suicide has no part in the world to come, is not buried in a Jewish cemetery, the family's put to shame. You know, families of the relative commit suicide in traditional Jewish groups. If the person commits suicide, they keep it quiet.
Mm.
You know, they don't talk about it. So suicide is looked down upon in the Jewish world. But there is I've seen discussions. This was actually a discussion that I was reading when I was in high school. I was like, we were studying the Book of Samuel for Bible classes when I was in high school. And back then I did the highest level you can do in high school, which is what's called 5 points. Now it's gone up to 7. But it's really funny because it's not less than what you, for example, do at least the first 2 years of university for your bachelor's. So it was pretty amazing what we did. Mm-hmm. And we read these passages, and I remember the teacher gave out this paper as a discussion about suicide in the Bible. And there was one of the sections there talked about the approach of suicide in Judaism. And there was a point there where it does mention an opinion in the Talmud. I can't remember where. It's really bogging me that I can't find it. Mm. But there was at least one rabbi who said that in certain situations, like the situation of Saul, that a person is allowed to commit suicide.
It's a more honorable death. There's no doubt about that. And as you mentioned, there's a long list of terrible, horrible things that you would want to avoid. And let's not forget, Yoel, he knew because Samuel told him that he was going to die. There was
so that's another side of it, that he knew he was going to die. So, okay, I'm going to kill myself. Because he was told, anyhow, you're going to die and you're going to be here with me.
Mm.
Okay, so...
So he ends it.
Yeah. So he ends it anyhow, because he knew. He anyhow knew. Really matter. Yeah, exactly. Anyhow knew.
The armor bearer follows suit. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those who were on the other side of the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Shaul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled. And the Philistines came and dwelt in them, Yoel.
You have to remember, the Philistines were a colonizing entity. They were Greeks, it seems, though. They're mentioned as Peleset or Pereset in Egyptian writings, and you can see that what they look like. And they're also called, you know, the nations of the sea, the Goyei Hayam. They're mentioned as well in the Bible. So these are colonizing entities. So for them to go conquer a city and to sit there was normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the same thing. For example, with the Muslims, the Arabs that came here, that they colonized cities that were cities before they came in. Like, for example, locations here in Israel, archaeological locations, we know where they are based on the name the Arabs gave the place. So, for example, there was a place called Tapuach. By the way, the word Tapuach in Hebrew means apple. There was a place called Tapuach, and there's a place called Kofel Tafuach, the village of Tafuach, which Tafuach is Tapuach in Arabic. The Arabic doesn't have a P sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then they knew that the place called Tapuach was somewhere in the vicinity of this village. Okay, so so by the way, we do have extra biblical information about kings committing suicide, and it says that they so there's an example. It's another example of a king committing suicide or requesting his armor bearer to kill him. Is an Assyrian record. There's an Assyrian record like that, and the Elamite king. There's a story about the Elamite king and his armor bearer also stabbed each other simultaneously. There's a record of that as well.
Uh-huh.
So this was something that was done in the ancient world. This wasn't so again.
So this is not an isolated case, is what you're saying.
We see at least one case. But again, you see one. You know, okay, big whoop. You know, but it seems that, you know, not all kings got into these situations. For example, a king might be captured and then, you know, the conquering king walks up and says, oh, listen, let's do this. Mm-hmm. You're a rich country. I kind of like you. You look like a nice guy. You know, let's do a treaty. You'll be my servant and I won't kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go back to your country and just sign this treaty that you submit your country to me. You know, so maybe there weren't too many situations like this. There were other ways of solving the problem. And even in the... To tell the truth, diplomacy in the ancient world was probably better than diplomacy we have today.
You think so?
To be blunt.
It was a lot less paperwork, Yoel.
I'm not too sure. It wasn't paperwork. It was clay work. It was heavier.
True. That's a good point.
But, you know, the point is that there were ways of solving it. So for us, committing suicide is like a big, drastic thing. But that comes from, you know, the Christian and Jewish background that most of us have. But we have this was something that was done, which means that Saul, again, is not acting outside of the culture that we're living in inside the ancient Near East.
Mm, fair enough. So listen, it says that it happened the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain. Now, to strip the slain, obviously, they're taking the armor or the loot, or the weapons or the any money they might have, whatever it is, anything that is of value, they take it from the slain. And they found Shaul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa, and they cut off his head, Yoel, and they stripped off his armor and sent word throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim in to proclaim it in the temple of their idols and among the people. And they put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. Now,
so there's several things that goes. First of all, the head.
The head was
a trophy.
The head wasn't, and we read about it a little later. Where is that?
We see in other places the concept of it being a trophy. First of all, Goliath's head.
That's right.
Is a trophy.
Yeah.
There's records in other places that the head is a trophy. Mm. It's a well-known thing. There are plenty of descriptions of kings' heads being. If you bring the person's head, you've proved that you actually killed him. Because you could bring in a hand or an arm or a leg or a torso, doesn't prove it's the person. When you bring the head, it's a symbol that that person is actually dead. Mm,
no
doubt. You can recognize him based on his face.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the head was used as a trophy. There's even a description somewhere that there was some king had a head as a trophy, and he was sitting in the garden with his wife and they were eating a feast, and the head was like hanging there on something, you know. That was like, oh, look, a head. Oh, wow, that's nice. So, but that's what they were doing.
Like what you've done with the garden, like the head there. It's very artistic.
I like the trophies.
Yeah. So listen, there's no mention of the head, but we find out later in 1 Chronicles 10 verse 10, it says they put his armor in the temple of their gods and fastened his head in the temple of Dagon.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And there's also something very interesting that in archaeology they discovered from this period there were the twin temples, one for Ashtoreth and one for Dagon.
Really?
So these might be the temples here, the temple mentioned here, and then completion in the book of the Book of Chronicles.
Mm.
So it seems that at this period there were actually twin temples in this area for these two deities. So this works fine. This works perfectly with history.
Mm-hmm. And so they separated the head from the body, and they put the body on the wall of Bethshan and the head in the temple of Dagon. However, it happened that the inhabitants of Yabesh Gilead. Now, where have we heard about them before, Yoel?
Well, Yabesh Gilead owes Saul big time. He saved them from Nachash, king of Ammon.
That's right. Now, that was chapter 11, I think?
That was eons ago, yeah.
That was eons ago, and we were talking about... Now, if I remember correctly, they were surrounded, and it was put to them, you know, come out and surrender to us and we'll pluck out your right eye and you can be our servants. And they said,
exactly.
Well,
and they sent out, and there was a whole trick there that they made them wait, and they didn't know that the help is coming, etc. You know, so it was a whole trick. And he went in, and this is the first real battle he was in as king. And they owed him big time.
Was it not one of the most noble if not the highlight of his kingship, would you say?
It was the thing that turned everything around. That
it certainly was.
Like, oh, okay, now we really have a king. We're not dealing with some guy who thinks he's a king.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's very fitting that those guys, the men of Yabesh Gilead, heard what the Philistines had done to Shaul. All the valiant men arose and traveled by night, all night, and took the body of Shaul.
They had to do this as an undercover operation, basically.
It was an undercover operation, and they took the body of Shaul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan. Now, I don't know if they got the head. We don't know if they got the head, but what they did...
Well, it says Gviato, so it probably might be, it might be they got the head. It might not be. It might be they didn't get the head. I mean, it was. You know, you had to go in and you had to steal it from. It seems it's from the temple itself. Mm. So it might have been a bit more difficult.
So we don't have those details. But they came to Yabesh and they burned them there. Now that's a really interesting thing, Yoel.
Cremation.
Where do we have cremation elsewhere in the Tanakh?
So it does mention that they did cremations for kings. It doesn't say anywhere in the Bible that a regular person was cremated. A person was just buried in a cave in the ground. Mm-hmm. But there are a few references to cremation. For example, it says, I think it talks about Zedekiah. Jeremiah says to Zedekiah, v'chim yisrafot avotecha yisrafu lach, that they would do the burnings that as they do these ancestors. But there's a discussion. Does it mean to burn the bodies or burn his personal items?
Mm.
There is a discussion. Did they actually burn bodies? So there's an opinion that says that here specifically because of the mutilation of the body and it's been rotting and everything, they burnt and only buried the bones. But the traditionally they used to bury actual bodies, entire bodies. But there's an opinion that says the kings were buried. They used to burn the body and only bury bones. So this was
one of the considerations. Yeah, some people take this very seriously because, I mean, as you said, we have people being entombed, we have people being buried, like Samuel was buried. But as for cremation, you know, some people think, well, is there a way that that my body should be disposed of or stored or kept? So
the thing is, again, we have to look at ancient culture versus modern culture.
Mm-hmm.
In the ancient world, there was a massive significance for the body to be intact and buried. Because the understanding was that you as a person, besides some spiritual side that you had, by the way, the word neshama does not appear anywhere in the Bible in the meaning of soul. Okay, neshama is from the word neshima, which is breathing. So it's a breathing creature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the word neshama, actually, I don't even know if the word neshama actually should be. I think it should appear in the Bible somewhere, but it might not. Let me just do a quick check.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, in the biblical times, even the Israelites, it seems that they didn't believe, it seems that they did believe in an afterlife of some sort, or that the spirit goes somewhere, because we sold the whole story.
Samuel, obviously.
Yeah, so we have the word neshama in the meaning of, there is a meaning of life force. There's a case, for example, in 1 Kings 17:17.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds as if it says there was no longer neshama, but it might mean that he was unable to breathe. So I don't know if it really means life force.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, the body had to stay intact. I mean, the Egyptians, for example, were really concerned about this. We're not talking about Egyptians, but the whole thing of mummification was an issue of survival. But they didn't have the Israelites didn't have the ancestral worship where they had to put food out and clothing and everything that they didn't have. Maybe they did have as a anti-Torah type of thing, but as the Torah itself says, bury the person. That's basically it. This it just mentions for example, you execute someone, you hang them, and then you bury them. So the Torah kind of hints to the burial practices of actually burying a whole body and not burning. So cremation. The problem also with cremation today, the way it's done is what's left of you is ashes.
They do a thorough job. You're right.
They only leave dust.
Mm.
And it seems that that would not have been acceptable. If you do cremation where you just burn just the flesh, that's something we still see because the bones. As I said, the word for bone is etzim, and the word etzim is also connected to the word atzmut and also for something which is real. So it seems that the bones were the essence because bones can last a very, very, very long time.
Mm.
So the bones were the essence of the person, the essence of the man.
Now, when you're talking like this, everyone's thinking of, what is it, Ezekiel 37 and the Valley of the Dry Bones and that the bones come together and so on and so forth. And people think, well, should when I die, should I ensure that I'm buried or whatever in such a way that my bones are still intact? Because is there going to be some form of resurrection by which my bones are going to play a part? I mean, what?
The problem is that, we have a few descriptions here and there. My guess is even if bones can last, first of all, bones can last for centuries, for millennia. There are bones which are discovered that people have died thousands of years ago. I would personally say that no cremation, just get a regular burial.
Get a regular burial. But having said that, we can also say, Yoel, that Adam was made from the dust of the ground and Yehovah made bones from that. So it's not as if, we don't have all the information and it's not as if, my uncle was cremated and what does that mean? Is it beyond our God? It's not beyond our God. But But it is interesting. These questions often come up.
Yeah, they come up. I've been asked about this question many times. I mean, I've had people that contacted me in panic about, what's going to happen after I die? What about this? What about that? And it's very interesting. The Bible doesn't really give you that much information about any of this stuff. It's only concerned about the physical world.
And one of the really curious things, Yoel, because we know that when it talks about the preservation of the body and it talks about the bones, we see Joseph says, he says, when you go, and I know because it's prophesied, when you go and you leave this place, take my bones with you. Why did he say that, do you think?
He didn't want to be buried in Egypt. He wanted to be buried in the land of the promised land. And also, you have to remember, he would have become an object of idol worshiping. He didn't want that either.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, there's an interesting statement in the Talmud that they say that Serapis was Joseph, mm-hmm. that the god of healing, of medicine, or something like that, was a dream interpretation, I think, also. I can't remember exactly the details about Serapis, but there's a statement they say that Serapis was Joseph, mm-hmm. that he became an idol in the Egyptian world after he died. Mm-hmm. So there's a major value to the issue of being buried in your father's land in the ancestral land. Mm-hmm. It was a very, very important thing for a lot of people. You know, I know there are a lot of stories for even today of people that died outside of Israel and requested that they'll be buried in Israel as the ancestral land.
Fair enough. And so, speaking of Joseph, because the very last verse of 1 Samuel. It says that there they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Yabesh and fasted 7 days. Now, if I remember correctly, Yoel, I think we have a fasting of 7 days in Job. I think we have one also in Genesis in regards to, is it in regards to Joseph or is it Jacob?
I think it's Jacob. It says that they fasted for 7 days. So it seems that fasting was part of the issue of mourning. I mean, the Bible doesn't give us too much information about how mourning is done, but we do know that, for example, amongst the nations, the whole thing of cutting yourself, pulling out your hair, etc. But we do know, for example, shaving was a common practice of mourning. Mm-hmm.
And that's where Leviticus chapter 19, verse 27.
Yeah, exactly. There's a claim tattooing is somehow involved as well. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've actually read a few researches on that. It's probably not correct. Tattooing had nothing to do with mourning over the dead. Mm-hmm. I did a long research because I read through different cultures and everything, and it's most cultures tattooed for different reasons. It was a relatively new thing, this whole idea of tattooing as memory of someone that died. If someone tattooed a name of someone that died, it was actually part of the idol worshipping, not the mourning practice.
Right.
There was this idea, someone said, oh, you cut yourself and throw the ashes in and that makes a tattoo. That's not accurate either. Because the ashes don't create the tattoo. Tattoos are done in two different ways. Either you insert ink into the cut. Or that you cut, you scar the skin in a way where the tear itself heals with a scar. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't. I don't know about throwing ashes into that because I don't know if ashes actually do anything. Mm. But that's besides the point. So fasting was a form because fasting was also a way of showing grief.
Yep.
That you're sad and everything. So that was a way. Also, a lot of people lose their appetite when they're depressed.
Sure. Well, there you go. But at least in this way, Yoel, there's some, even though, look, Shaul was a disappointment. Let's say he was a disappointment as a king. He was a disappointment to God as a king. And he suffered the consequences. However, at least there was some kind of dignity in the end, and some kind of honor to him as a Mashiach, as an anointed one of Yehovah.
Yeah, I mean, David. I think you have to remember there was emphasis here that he's referred as Mashiach Adonai by David, mm-hmm. and so it's emphasized. He was a chosen one of God, but he made several mistakes along the way, several serious mistakes along the way, and he had to be punished, so he was killed. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't completely disregarded. You know, God said, okay, he's dead. Now he gets a proper burial. Mm-hmm. Proper burial, one of the signs of, I don't know if it's a sign of forgiveness, but it seems that the fact that he got a proper burial was a good thing in the end. That he at least he got buried normally, because, you know, it's always very saddening when someone that's get buried and you don't know who it is.
It's a fitting way to end The Office, right? I mean, he deserves, yeah, regardless of whether he was a good king, a bad king, he was a king. He was an anointed king of Israel, but it was fitting that it should end like this, at least.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he got a proper burial, and they were mourning over him. It's not just that he died. I mean, his sons died as well. You know, David takes it very, yeah, very hard. We'll read. Yeah, he starts crying over Jonathan. You know, this was a very, very strong, close friendship. And we'll get to this when we actually get back from the break.
It's such a shame that we're taking a break on such a low note. We're really at a low note at the moment.
Yeah, it's a very, very low note. But on the other hand, you know, the high note here is that Saul dies and now David becomes king.
Mm-hmm.
And now he can really start using his office to actually really start fixing things. And the first thing he does is he establishes his kingship. He goes against the Philistines. The Philistines kind of vanish after King David.
Mm.
They're no longer a nuisance.
Mm.
It can also be connected to, you know, he becomes a king. He makes alliances. Up to now, there are no alliances. Up to now, it's a Saul by himself. You know, he's chasing David around. There's technically two kings in the land, and he's just obsessed about David. Now he dies, and his death, though it's a sad thing, we do know that he does go to the afterlife with Samuel.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good thing. He and his sons both, he gets a proper burial. That's a high note.
Mm-hmm.
But the high note here as well is it enables David to start functioning.
That's right. So now David takes center stage. He's in the limelight, and that's what we have to look forward to when you and I return eventually to 2 Samuel, when we'll read all about that.
And by the way, when we get back to 2 Samuel, I'll already be inside my first temple history course and actually got the books. And the first book is actually entitled The History of the People of Israel in the First Temple, The Unified Kingdom. And the first unit talks about David and Saul.
There it is. Beautiful. The timing is perfect. So
I'm going to start cracking on these books pretty soon.
We're going to let you study that up in time for when we do return to 2 Samuel. We will be taking a hiatus. We will be taking a break. And so let me take the opportunity, Yoel, to thank you, because, look, just a reminder to the listeners, I mean, how many books have we done now? We've done Joshua, Judges. We have to do Ruth. We will be doing Ruth at some stage.
Oh, we might do Ruth as a special, maybe.
We got to do it for Shavuot, right?
Yeah, we want to do it for Shavuot. We never got around to doing it because someone forgot. I can't remember who it was. One of us forgot to do it, and we really want to do the Book of Ruth. Book of Ruth is a very, very interesting book. There's actually a few interesting things that I came up with lately about the Book of Ruth. So we might do a special just for the Book
of Ruth.
We're
going to do it. We will do a special. Yeah. And First Samuel, so and all the other programs that we've done, like I said, we've done something like 90 programs, as you said, over 2.5 years, and you've been very generous with your time. And so I just want to remind the listeners, if you would like to give back to Yoel for everything that he has given to us in going through these books systematically, the website that you can contact him on is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. If you send him an email, he'll let you know how you can do that. And I would highly encourage listeners to do that. If they would like to give back to Yoel, certainly worth donating towards, a cause to donate towards. So thank you, my friend. Thank you for being so generous with your time.
I'm going to really be missing these programs. I mean, you have to call me every once in a while. Don't say like, oh, I'm busy doing other things. Give me a call.
What do you mean? I'm coming round. I'll be coming round to your house in March.
Yeah, but we might restart the program before you come back here.
We may.
Let's see. But also, there are other programs we did. There was a whole series. We did four programs about Shabbat. We did programs about different subjects. It wasn't just the Light of the Prophets. There were other things that we've done in the past. Hopefully, when Jono gets when you get the website up and running, get all the different programs we did.
You'll be able
I need my own little thing there. It's not fair.
Your own little page where you can
bounce off to
all the little. We will be doing that. So stay tuned, listeners, because we will be making pages, and easier to navigate around and to find past programs.
And the big plus is going to be that when we get to the Book of Kings, I'm already going to be done with this course of First Temple history, which means when we do the Book of Kings, which hopefully will be somewhere in the next Gregorian calendar, next year for 2014, you know, it'll take us several months. I mean, because there's almost 30 chapters in 2 Samuel. That by itself is maybe another 6 months of reading.
Yeah.
But hopefully somewhere in the summer of 2014, we'll already be in the Book of Kings. We'll be able to start the Book of Kings. And then I'm going to be already done with my history course, which means...
You'll be oozing with knowledge.
I will be oozing with knowledge about the Book of Kings. I'll have more references. Also, I'm going to be a full-fledged student, which means I have access to libraries. You know, I actually already have several history books here of that period.
Mm-hmm.
Being able now to, if there's anything specific I want to research, I just take my student card and say, "Hey, I need this book." Mm-hmm. There's a big library in the Haifa University that I'm allowed to have access to. The nice thing about the Open University is they have agreements with the big universities that mm-hmm. actually have campuses that Open University students can actually go in to the university library and That's use great. It for research.
What a blessing.
So, and I can also do a request to take books out. There's an insurance by my university that I paid for. So if any book gets lost, you know, it's covered.
You're like a kid in a lolly shop now.
Oh, believe me, it's fun. No, the thing is that it used to be, for example, in the Hebrew University, you could have walked into the library, even as a regular person without a student card. You walk in and you pay a certain amount of money every year and you can borrow books, and they stopped it. I actually had a very good friend who was he's very similar to me. We don't think the same way, but again, he's a very, very good researcher. He's just a guy who goes to yeshiva. And he would spend several hours a week in the library. And one day he walked in, they said, he can't come in anymore. He was very upset about that. I was very upset because I was about to go in there.
Yeah. Now it's on tap for you. Hey, Liz, also we should let the listeners know you will be continuing to do the Torah portion with Jeff Gilbert Torah.
Yeah, I'm going to be doing the Torah portion with Talking Torah. I'm also doing a Bible group that's already started.
Mm.
Really enjoying that one. The group is a really, really great group.
Just to let listeners know, you can keep up to date with those podcasts with Jeff on, you're going to put them on Hebrew in Israel, the Facebook page.
I put them on Hebrew in Israel Facebook page.
Excellent.
So that's going to be a mean of communication with me. I started making videos as well. I've decided that.
Yeah.
Though I'm good in writing things out, I'm getting better at it. Specifically, I'm writing something as like 200 words or something. I'm getting better, but it's easier for me to express myself while speaking because my English spelling is. I've received some funny remarks from people. Not nasty remarks, just funny remarks about, you know, I think you meant this word. I'm like, yeah, you're right. I'm perfectly fine with that. You have to remember, when you're bilingual and you can read both languages, one of them gets left behind a little. So my English spelling is not that great. My grammar is not that great. And
it's
your
second language.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be my first language, by the way. Mm. I first spoke English as a child and then switched to Hebrew. But Ira was poking some fun at me at my spelling and the way I speak. But in any case, I'm putting videos up. I'm going to republish the video I did on Zechariah 12:10. I'm republishing that one on the YouTube channel. So if you want to be able to follow the videos, you can subscribe to the YouTube channel. So that's a new project that I'm working on doing videos also. So there's right. something that you can also hear me explain.
So YouTube channel, the Facebook page, Hebrew in Israel, so you can keep up to date with Yoel there. So that's great. That's
yeah, by the way, there's also a website. There's a WordPress website, but I don't really use it that much because it seems it doesn't really catch on. People are not really like, ooh, there's a website. It's not... One day there will be a proper website, okay?
All right, it's coming. We'll keep listeners up to date when that happens. Exactly. My friend, thank you again, and thank you for all of your time. We really do appreciate it. Eventually, you and I will get back together to do 2 Samuel. But until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom. Kol tov for now.
For now. There we go. How about that?
Yep.
We're done.
We're done. We're done with this. And it actually makes me a little sad because I've been enjoying this. This has been fun.